The Guardian.
But I don't see why I'm telling Electro's story when he's perfectly able to tell his own. So let's listen and see what Electro has to say to us today. All right, Electro, will you tell your story, please?
Who? Me?
Yes, you.
Okay, Toots. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll be very glad to tell my story. I am a smart fellow, as I have a very fine brain.
Hello and welcome to another episode of A Neuroscientist Explains. I'm Dr. Daniel Glazer, and I am a neuroscientist. I'm also director of Science Gallery London, that's going to open in 2018 as part of King's College London, although we're running beautiful programming already. I think we all know what the point of the podcast is. Each week I've got a column in the Observer magazine, but it's only 200 words long. So although it allows me to engage with neuroscience in a contemporary context, I have to do it very briefly. So in this podcast, we get to explore stuff at a little bit more length. As you know by now, each episode begins with a single conversation, which ironically this week is mediated through a digital platform.
Hello?
Hi, Dan. It's Max.
Hey, Max. How you doing?
Anyway, each episode begins with a single conversation.
It's nice, kind of windy down here, but catching up on a whole week of stuff.
Between me?
Yeah, it's good to be back in the city, looking up at the Shard.
And producer Max.
Yeah, exactly. Who needs the countryside when you got the Shard?
Well, you know, that's how I feel in each place, right? When I'm in the country, it's great to be in the country. When I'm in the city, it's great to be back here.
And obviously, now that you're back from holiday, you'll be writing your column again. So, Dan, what are you writing about this week?
Well, Max, I'm quite interested in the putative rise of the robot. And this kind of, is it growing, Max? It certainly seems to be prevalent, fear of them taking over our jobs, and even the singularity, this idea that they're going to become smarter than we are and we'll become obsolete and maybe even extinct as a result. And it's led me to think a little bit about what the comparisons that we can make are between robot intelligence, shall we say artificial intelligence, and natural intelligence, shall we say human intelligence, and how we can compare the two, and maybe even how we can use our understanding of human intelligence to make robots even smarter, which is probably a bad idea if you think they might be taking over, but, you know, so potentially death wish. But as a scientist, of course, I'm morally neutral. I'm just curious to see what will happen.
And it's funny you mention morals there, because I'll let the listeners into a little secret. That's how myself and yourself, well, not we first met. We actually no, it was. The first time we met was I was interviewing you about artificial intelligence. And then the second time we met, I believe, you were on a panel, which I was chairing.
Expertly, Max, expertly. Yes.
Thank you very much. And it was all about ethical robots. It was this idea, I think it was even, and I can't claim that I came up with the name, but it was why robot can we make ethical machines? And so that is something that people kind of have a big issue with. And so is that what the column is about? Is it about, can we teach robots to be ethical? Is that the angle you've gone for?
I mean, I suppose that my thought about that is, and this led me to the inquiry that I think we're going to have this week, is that the idea that we would sort of retrofit ethics to robots is a kind of a weird one. So people who like science fiction will know Isaac Asimov, and he's come up years ago with some sort of rules for robots, how they ought to behave. And actually, Max, the British Standards Institute, which is the thing that kind of specifies what your plugs should look like and, you know, how much fuse you need for a particular device and how slippy work surfaces need to be, or floors, you know, in kitchens, have also come up with a new standard for robots, the kinds of things that you'd want to build into a robot. But what's interesting to me as a neuroscientist in all this is that that's exactly back to front when we think about how humans develop. So if we think about human intelligence, we teach children ethics and morals, like, you know, don't steal Johnny's pencil and sit quietly in the class and don't interrupt and say please and say thank you. And we make sure that we've nailed all of that kind of stuff before we start teaching them algebra and complex reasoning. And so it occurred to me that maybe the artificial intelligence approach has got everything back to front, that we should be considering developing moral agents, computers that perhaps even understand other people's feelings and know the difference between right and wrong. And once we've developed that capability, we could start to get them to do the really complex and interesting tasks, which are going to result in our losing all of our jobs and maybe they're taking over the world. So as I say, I have mixed feelings. If you're worried about robots taking over the world, you probably won't support this enterprise, because I think if we think this way, they'll get smarter quicker.
And am I right? I'm going to take a slight philosophical tangent, because I do love a philosophical tangent.
I'll allow you a tangent.
Thank you very much. Am I right in thinking that there's a Kantian idea from Immanuel Kant, who kind of talks about the fact that intelligence isn't even possible without these, and I'm going to pronounce this wrong, so forgive me in advance, a priori ethics. Is that
a priori ethics? Yeah.
A priori ethics.
Okay, well, so I've got how you pronounce the Latin and you've got the Kantian philosophy. So yeah, that may be true, but my hunch this week is that that might be the case. And I guess if we think about human intelligence and machine intelligence, there are probably two different sorts of development or cycle for the human thing that we might want to think about. And here, Max, I think we're going to talk ontogeny and phylogeny a little bit. So
two words for the word bank there.
For the word bank, ontogeny, phylogeny. So if you think about how, you know, a human brain, yours, Max, or anyone listening, how that brain came to be as smart as it is, there are two kinds of journeys through time that you want to be thinking about. So one is an evolutionary journey through all of our ancestors, who in this sense probably were getting smarter and smarter. So we want to resist the idea that humans are at the top of the tree of evolution and we are the most perfectible thing, because crocodiles are pretty good and bacteria and fungi have got a good shout at being, you know, more evolutionarily successful than we are. But certainly when it comes to intelligence, it feels as if, you know, there is some sort of journey that our ancestors have been on which culminates in us. And we call that the phylogenetic development, which is phylus, I think, is a term that's used in genetics to mean, you know, that the path or the group that we're part of. And so we can think about how we evolve to become smart. And then the ontogenetic thing says, how did the brain that's in your head, Max, come to be as it is, starting at conception through the development in the womb and through childhood and Max, in your case, approaching at least maturity. So, you know, what's going on there? And I think that when we look at the way that artificial intelligence is trying to build stuff, we may be asking questions both about how human brains came to be in evolution and how they develop within a given skull as the person grows up. And those are both questions that I want to look at this week.
And one of the places that neuroscientists hang out in the wild in London is quite near to Hampstead Heath.
Press firmly.
Hello, John.
Hello, Dan.
Nice to see you. This is Max.
Hi, John. Hi, Max. Lovely to meet you. How are you?
This is Professor John Morton.
Oh, I'm John Morton, and I'm an emeritus at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience at University College London.
John's also an old friend of mine. His wife and my mum used to work together, and many moons ago we were colleagues at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience. Producer Max and I joined him for a cup of tea and some delicious biscuits in his cosy front room this week. So the column this week, I'm not going to tell you what the punchline of it is, because that's what I want to ask you at the end. But it's led me to think about the development of cognition, particularly higher brain function, how we think about complicated things in the world. And I guess what I'm really interested in is two things. One is what we know about the architecture of the brain structures that do this kind of thinking. And I could think about them, you know, as in terms of wet stuff, neural tissue, or functionally, you know, what are the circuits which we think give rise to it? And then the other question I'm interested in is, what are the processes at the end of which we get to do all this complicated thinking? You know, is there a set path that takes us from, you know, conception through childhood, through education and maturity to these very complicated ways of thinking? Or is it the kind of thing, you know, which under some imaginable premise you could arrive straight at or cut some corners to. And I'm aware that not only perhaps does no one know the answers to these questions, but you might say that they're not questions which, you know, you're the best person in the world to answer, but still I know you know a lot more about these kinds of things than I do. And so can we go with architecture first? And I wonder, John, whether you think it's useful to distinguish between the architecture, I've now, Max, started using my hands already, so, you know, of the bits of the brain, the front bit, the back bit, and all of those complicated nuclei and lobes, or whether you think the right way to think about this architecture is in more abstract terms of reasoning circuits and memory circuits and so on. What's your preferred way to think about the architecture of the machinery in the human that does all this complicated thinking stuff?
Well, the my preference is to go for the function rather than the brain itself. I used to claim that it made little difference to psychological theory if we regarded the brain as being actually in the big toe. This didn't go down very well with more more biological colleagues. And but the point I was making was that a proper psychological theory could be implemented in any sort of computational device, and the brain is a particular kind of computational device. Now, that may end up not to be, strictly speaking, true. There may be certain restrictions from the brain onto the kinds of computation that could be made, but whether those would be universal to do with the brain, any brain, any animal or that had neurons, or whether it's to do with the particular way that the brain gets configured in humans compared with other animals because of the genetic contribution to our development. Well, I think I'd prefer the latter.
So, I mean, the column is Neuroscientist Explains. For what it's worth, I did, you know, all the neuroscience that I did. And so I just wondered, does that mean that you set yourself up in opposition to neuroscientists who would seek to understand more and more deeply and in more and more detail the fine structures of the brain? Do you think that's a distraction if you're trying to understand thinking?
Yes, frankly. Because unless you have a clear model of what the functions are in thinking, you don't know what it is you're assigning to which bits of the brain. You want to say that a bit of the brain does something or other. You know, what is this thing that we're talking about? It's a component of a psychological theory. It has to be. And if it isn't yet, then you have to do that work before you can do the mapping from the brain onto it. I mean, it isn't really very interesting to map from the brain onto a piece of behaviour, since any piece of behaviour could come about for a number of different reasons. I mean, you could move your hand up because I asked you to, or because you've got a twitch on there, a fly lands on it, because you're trying to demonstrate some particular kind of motion to me.
We always use hand movements in the podcast, particularly because it's a radio, it's an audio medium, John, so we always find ourselves talking about hand movements and then trying to describe them as we go. But thank you for that analogy. And again, so explain, the thought is that if you start with the brain and try to plot that onto behaviour, you're doing things the wrong way around. You need to understand what the behaviour is and then try to understand what the structure that sort of gives rise to it.
You need to understand what the behaviour is, you need to understand what the functional system is that's producing that behavior, and then map the brain onto that. I think that the brain is concerned with function primarily. That's the way it organizes itself, unless you get the language which describes the function appropriately, you're only going to get very approximate answers. I mean, to say that visions in the front of the brain and motor cortex is towards the rear and things of that kind is not that much in principle different from phrenology. Ouch! Somebody hit me.
That's all right. I talked about phrenology in the last episode, didn't I, Max? We admit of phrenology and its relevance. Now, I mean, yeah. There's a kind of a strong and a weak version of what you're saying. The weak version of it says that, I mean, maybe something like, until we've sufficiently characterized
function in psychological terms, until we really understand this stuff, you know, we're not really going to make progress in understanding the structure of the brain and so on. The strong version would say that actually it's a huge waste of time and money for us to be doing all of this imaging, scanning, recording from humans and animals without the proper theoretical grounding. Do you think people ought to lay off for a couple of decades till we've sorted out the psychology?
I think it would save an awful lot of money.
Stopping it would save money whether or not it's a good idea to do it. I mean, maybe we should, you know, yes, to put it all into social care and give up on the brain altogether. But the strong claim would be slightly different, which is to say that it's actually an active distraction and a waste of time to be doing all of this brain imaging and investigation of fly circuits and rats and stuff.
I think the main problem is the relative evaluation. If brain studies and scanning are valued far more than experimental psychology and the theories that spring out of experimental psychology, then that's a mistake. And you can find many people in university teaching universities who have no real idea what cognition is for or why you might use it. I mean, isn't the brain what psychology is? No, it's not, I would want to say.
What is the brain?
Yes, what is the brain?
So I'm going to give my view here just for a second. I think John is being provocative. He reckons that until we have elaborated models of what thinking is, of what behaviour is, there's no point in getting neuroscientific data because that will just confuse us. I'm not sure that even John reckons that that's right. My own sense is that as we amass more and more detailed information about the brain, that can help us to develop better models. But he is right that a lot of neuroscience proceeds in what we would call an a-theoretical manner. We gather stuff without any hypothesis to test about what's really going on in the big picture. And in my view, there's no better big picture guy than John Morton. And after this short break, we'll hear about what John's big picture actually looks like.
It would look like a description of some computing device. And there'll be elements. I usually actually use boxes and arrows because this is a convenient way of depicting certain kinds of things and the relationships among these things.
And we'll also hear what this approach means for artificial intelligence.
As a human, I want to feel that as a human I'm different and that no robot will ever replace me. Mm-hmm. But as a scientist, I have a suspicion that in the end, one will be able to create a silicon version which will be able to do everything.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to recommend another one of our podcasts here at The Guardian. It's called Chips with Everything and explores our ever-evolving relationship with technology and digital culture. Recent episodes include a chat with Guardian journalist Ewan McCaskill about the state of surveillance under Trump, a look back at the informal dining club that spawned the British cybernetics movement, and a look forward to the future of self-repairing cities. To listen, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Chips with Everything on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to A Neuroscientist Explains. I'm Daniel Glazer. And before the break, we heard from Professor John Morton about his modelling approach to the human brain.
I used to claim that it made little difference to psychological theory if we regarded the brain as being actually in the big toe. This didn't go down very well with more, more biological colleagues. But the point I was making was that a proper psychological theory could be implemented in any sort of computational device, and the brain is a particular kind of computational device.
And while we covered the wonderful world of brain imaging on last week's podcasts, go have a listen if you haven't already, John's devised an alternative way of making pictures of the brain. Give people who haven't read your work a sense of what a John Morton model of a thing would be.
Well, it would look like a description of some computing device. And there would be elements. I usually actually use boxes and arrows because this is a convenient way of depicting certain kinds of things and the relationships among these things. I don't believe that there are boxes and arrows in the head, of course, which I have occasionally been accused of doing.
So you really don't? I mean, when you draw... Max will link on the page to some of John's papers so people can look... I mean, you know, even if they don't delve into them, get a visual sense of what they are. Mm-hmm. But when you're building these models of boxes and arrows and things connecting to each other, you don't secretly wonder whether that box corresponds to the amygdala and that one is the cerebellum and that one's frontal cortex?
No, never. I'm tempted to do it from time to time because I know that if I did, more people would refer to it.
Very good.
Like I say, if you're interested to have a look for yourself at one of John's pictures, click on the link on the Guardian website. But briefly, what he does is to make boxes that represent different functional units of the brain that might be underlying the behaviours and the measurements that he makes on humans. And arrows and lines join them up to produce... a model of how we, for example, remember or associate smells or whatever behaviour he's interested in. The interesting point is that none of the boxes correspond to actual bits of the brain. They're functional units. Although he does say he occasionally slips in some neuroscience technology to increase the number of citations he gets within the literature.
Phenomena you're describing, the memory or the...
But something I still wanted to understand was how this modelling approach connects in with the development of the human brain.
You think about them not in terms of brain structures, wet stuff, but in terms of boxes and lines and diagrams of that sort. And I just wonder whether there are two developmental questions which I wonder about when you think of these models. So the first is, do you think about how they evolved to be? So do you think about, I mean, you don't think about the brain as a neural thing particularly, but it's a processing system. Do you think about what more primitive brains or earlier, shall we say, evolutionary brains were doing, steps towards this beautifully, you know, high thinking being that we are? Do you think about the intermediate steps to that ever when you're constructing your models?
No, I don't actually. There are two other ways of thinking about it. One of them is to take the adult state and describe the adult state as best you may. I've worked in development. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in a sense, you're talking about two kinds of journey to the functioning adult brain of a human. One is the journey through species from our ancestors and through evolution, and that would be called phylogenetic. And I guess then there's the journey which we take, as it were, from conception through childhood and adolescence and maturation, and that would be the ontogenetic development. Do either of those journeys play a role in your models? For example, do you think about what the role of education is or what a child brain would look like when you're building your models?
Certainly, yes. I ended up as a developmental psychologist, and in that guise, I certainly had to take into account the ontogenetic trajectory, which also, by the way, included a role of biology.
If you are thinking about development and children, it does sort of invite biology a bit, because your model of the adult functioning is a boxes and lines model, but you need, don't you, if you're a developmental psychologist, to have another set of boxes and lines which are a little bit smaller. The boxes are smaller, the lines are shorter because it's just growing up. Is that the way you think about it? The biology is just the fact that you start smaller and get bigger, or how does it play into your models?
No, it's not like that at all. As a child develops, and they have different... you may want to have a different description of what is happening at different ages. And the question is, how do you motivate the move from one to the other? And it may be that what motivates the move is, say, the accumulation of more information. This information gets restructured, new concepts come along, and so on. And that is, you can describe the shift from one state to another entirely psychologically. But it might be that there is some brain development such that, for example, the frontal cortex gets hooked up in a way which it wasn't hooked up before. And that shift enables a different kind of computation to take place, unmotivated by any psychological considerations. So in development, I came to the conclusion, my previous strictures on the relationship between biology and psychology no longer hold.
Very interesting. And just to two quick thoughts on that. So the first is, are you saying that you could not imagine the adult model arising except as a consequence of some child models which the organism or the machine needed to go through to get to that adult state?
Yes, with the caveat that one really has no idea about what sorts of things trigger restructuring, and these restructurings could be spontaneous, and they could be a product of some biological shift even in adult.
Very good.
Very good indeed, especially for this week's column.
The column is prompted by the rise of robots and the idea that artificial intelligence will take over things that humans do. And I'm going to guess, Max, that, you know, what John will say to the two questions, and he's old enough and smart enough not to be influenced by my guesses, except perhaps to disagree with me on principle. We'll see how that works out. So the first is, I think you're saying, certainly when it comes to higher brain function in adults, because you don't care about the biology, because you don't care if it's the front of the brain or the back of the brain, that a sufficiently complex machine made of silicon, for example, could, in principle, do any function which a biological human brain could do. So in a sense, your modelling approach suggests that with sufficiently complex silicon and with a good enough understanding of the function, we should be able to implement any kind of human cognition or thinking in a machine.
That's the consequence of that position, yes.
And do you believe that, as a matter of fact?
Mm-hmm. At the moment, yes, yes. Of course, as a human, I want to feel that as a human I'm different and that no robot will ever replace me. Mm-hmm. But as a scientist, I have a suspicion that in the end, one will be able to create a silicon version which will be able to do everything.
Okay. And then I guess the interesting question for me then is, how do you make the silicon version do those things? And my suspicion at the moment, and this is the one I want to test on you, is that by going straight to the adult competence, by training up networks with adult behaviours, we're less likely to get them to be smart than if we follow the developmental journey of the human. That it might be sensible to start them on basic tasks. I actually even think basic behaviours like sitting up straight, paying attention, knowing when to listen and when to talk, when to shut up and when to be bolshy, not to steal stuff, perhaps even to be good. That these things which we teach human children before we teach them algebra and the history of the decline of the Roman Empire, that these developmental stages might be necessary also for silicon brains to get to be as smart as we are. Does that make any sense to you as a developmental psychologist?
I think that's absolutely right. That I'm sorry to have to agree with
I'm
you.
I'm devastated, John.
there's the other thing that, however, that it looks as if there are certain predispositions in human development. For example, the human child spontaneously comes up with a distinction between moral behaviour and conventional behaviour. For example, a four-year-old, a three-year-old, early three-year-old, won't make a distinction between a boy dressed in a girl's skirt and somebody hitting somebody. That comes in at late three, four.
So they're both unusual behaviours, but one is wrong.
Yes, and the experiments have gone on to show that if you say to somebody, how bad is it for a boy to dress in a girl's skirt? Oh, it's really terribly bad. But supposing you were in a different country where everybody else did it, would that be all right? Oh, yes, that'd be all right. But would it be all right to hit somebody? No. So there's a basis of that, which, of course, will inevitably get shaped by the circumstances the child finds himself in. And if the people are hitting each other all over the place in their local environment, then they will change their view of these things.
So if we're not threatened by the rise of AI and actually from the perspective of neuroscience or psychology want to aid it, we might advise them to look more carefully at the development of the human from childhood to adulthood as a way to get smarter quicker.
Yes, yes. The big risk is that they go blundering in thinking that from their intuitions they will be able to do the right thing I think things are much more complicated than that, and it's the accumulated wisdom of an awful lot of people working in a lot of different areas, which have been necessary. And even nowadays, at the present moment, we still don't have enough information, I think, to do the job properly.
Thank you very much, John. That was brilliant. I feel, well, again, Max, I'm, you know, a little disappointed to be agreed with, but I think that's been a beautiful trajectory. Thank you.
So there you have it. Artificial intelligence and machine learning may be the new kid on the block, but maybe it needs to be held back a year or two in school if it's going to reach its full potential. Special thanks this week to Professor John Morton. We'll include a link to some of John's work in the episode's description on the Guardian website, so make sure to check it out. We'll also include a link to the Guardian's original short film, Intelligence Explosion, which looks at some of the quandaries involved when it comes to ethical robots. This episode of A Neuroscientist Explains was presented by me, Dr. Daniel Glazer, and the producer was Max Sanderson. Both of us will be taking a well-earned break for a while, but don't worry, listeners, we'll be back soon, bigger and better than before, with our very own podcast. So please do keep your ears to the ground and keep your eyes peeled for A Neuroscientist Explains, the podcast, on iTunes and other favoured podcast apps. In the meantime, please do keep sending any thoughts, feedback, or neuroscience queries to aneuroexplains, all one word, at gmail.com. They can keep producer Max busy while I'm away. Adios for now.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.